Welcome again to another edition of our Jewish Sacred Aging podcast. This is your host, Richard Address. These podcasts are coming to you on jewishsacredaging.com. And for this session, we are very pleased and honored to welcome Dr. David Teutsch, professor of contemporary Jewish civilization at the Reconstructionist Rabbinic College and the director of their Center for Jewish Ethics. David, welcome to our Jewish Sacred Aging podcast. Very nice of you to join us. Thank you.
Delighted to be here.
Good to speak with you. I want to start really with a follow-up. You gave this really wonderful talk at a convention, a conference a couple of months ago in February out in Phoenix, the title of which was Preserving Quality of Life Toward the End of Life, a Value-Based Approach. This was at a conference at ASU, Arizona State, entitled Health, Mortality, and Morality, Jewish Perspectives. And I'd like to know if you could possibly walk us through what you mean by this value-based approach to the end of life.
Sure. Most people who are contemplating the very difficult decisions we make in the last stages of our lives, it's important to think about how they measure the preservation of their dignity, the avoidance of pain, the concern with feelings of family, as each of those things are, of course, legitimate values, against the traditional Jewish imperative of pikuach nefesh, saving a life, or to put it in more contemporary terms, how do you measure, as you make decisions, between length of life and quality of life? People who are facing an end of life that is either involves loss of use of their bodies or increased pain or dementia, preserving life at all costs is something that many of us consider to be not the best choice. So values-based decision making says we have to figure out what things are important to us, how we balance these values against each other, and how we then carry out a decision that we may need to do alone, or we may be able to get help with, depending on the willingness of the people around us and also the state of the law in the particular state or jurisdiction we're in.
That leads to a very interesting question. And just jumping off of your last statement, I live in New Jersey. You live in Pennsylvania. In New Jersey, we have a choice in dying bill that's stuck somewhere in the state legislature. Never really passed the lower house. Never got to the assembly, the Senate last year. There are now five states where various aspects of this are legal, and the last one being California. From your perspective and your teaching and your understanding of our tradition in the text, can we favor institutionally the passage of these choice in dying laws based upon the Oregon law of about 15 years ago?
Well, what exactly is included in the right to die laws varies hugely place to place. The new California law is vastly more restrictive than the Oregon law. But in general, I would say that even a quite strict interpretation of Jewish law allows for pain control trumping length of life. And if we're talking about more liberal Jews, the choice of opting for quality of life seems to me to be one that there's a very significant portion of the American Jewish community would support. So given that that's the case, I would say that the leadership of the liberal part of the Jewish community should certainly support that legislation. And I would argue on the basis of freedom of religion that the more traditional elements ought to support it as well.
Is there any value in our tradition? Because we get asked this all the time, I'm sure you do too. Is there any value in our tradition of suffering? physical suffering, you know?
Not really. I mean, there is a Talmudic rationalization that if you suffer in this world, it means you avoid suffering in the next. But most of us don't believe in that kind of individual reward and punishment. It's certainly not a required belief of Jewish tradition. And we certainly have statements of rabbis who, when asked, do you want to continue this suffering, answer emphatically no. So I would say the bulk of our tradition does not recognize any connection between suffering and penitence the way some other traditions do.
And the use of palliative care. Talk to us a little bit about, in your system of value-based decision-making, this idea of the role of palliative care, comfort care, hospice care, which seems to be a growing phenomenon and really seems to be more accepted across the denominational lines.
Well, to start with, it's clear that anyone can decide how much medical care is in their interest, or to use the Hebrew, letovatam. And if you decide that the pain or difficulty or lack of effectiveness in the medical care makes it more sensible to move away from curative medical care, that has always been a recognized and accepted Jewish option. The reason palliative care has emerged more strongly in recent years is that modern medicine has a capacity to prolong life in a way that its forerunners of even 60 or 70 years ago did not. And palliative care says, okay, once you've decided that curative measures are no longer appropriate, you deserve the best care you can get that will be pain relieving and comforting and dignity preserving. So the core of the palliative care movement, which is to preserve dignity, kavod, to avoid pain, which is, in keeping with our value of Tzar Balei Chaim, avoiding pain to all creatures, is very much in the spirit of Judaism. And several of the pioneers in that movement actually were Jewish thinkers, some of them from the medical side and some of them from the rabbinic side.
So how do we justify or play with this concept of personal autonomy, choice, vis-a-vis the traditional concept of, wait a minute, this life belongs to God, this body belongs to God. I don't have the right to do anything I want, whenever I want, how I want.
So if you believe the body belongs to God, that means that you have to reject suicide, and you would probably reject the right to die in that sense. Mm-hmm. But even if you agree that the body belongs to God, that doesn't mean God wants you to suffer, and you can do whatever possible to ameliorate your suffering.
So this idea of context, I understand from the halachic point of view, from our traditional point of view, that there is this mood that we judge each case on its own merits, which I've always taken to mean that you really have to examine first the context of an individual, the case, and that whole system that surrounds that individual. Could you just talk a little bit about your understanding of how the role of context and individual context plays with these decisions?
Well, first, let's keep in mind that our tradition endorsed the notion that a person could make his or her own choices about what medical care they did or did not want. So the question of context doesn't come up so much when a person is making his or her own decisions. It comes up when that person is unable to, and another family member or whoever they've designated as their durable power of attorney for health care, their DPAC, is making the decisions for them. So if in that situation, we have to ask, what gives this person pleasure? What are the things that gave this person life meaning? Are they going to be available to this person at this stage in life? And I watched two cancer patients, both of whom were terminal, make very different decisions about that, because one of them said, the thing I love most is having a chance to see my family and my grandchildren, and I, as long as I'm healthy enough so that I can see them and enjoy their company, I want to keep living. And the other one said, there's nothing that justifies this level of pain for me. I want to go with as much painkiller as I can and die as soon as I can. And it seemed to me the difference between the two was what gave them succor and pleasure. And I wouldn't say one of them is right and the other wrong. Both of them were true to who they were. So one of the things we don't want in terms of context being influential is for people to be making decisions based on trying to preserve a family's estate or about other concerns that are political or financial, as opposed to questions about how to preserve the person's dignity, their pleasure, and minimize their pain.
You know, this conversation dealing with your value-based approach and some of the other conversations that are all over the place now and really deep and meaningful conversations raise a question that I wanted to ask you, and that is about vocabulary itself. With the ability of medical technology to extend life, prolong life, traditional contexts such as go sace, you know, the moribund patient whose death is imminent, or trefa, somebody who's marked for death, supposedly. Are we at a stage Jewishly in our community that we have to really redefine, reevaluate, and maybe even come up with new terminology to illustrate these various stages of life? We have all of our colleagues have dealt with, you know, people with dementia or Alzheimer's who can live for years. Are they go sace? Are they trefa? Or do we have to really invent some sort of new vocabulary?
Well, for starters, you're not a trefa until whatever your ailment is, is absolutely certain to be terminal. So if you have first or second stage cancer these days, the likelihood is it's not going to be terminal and you're not a trefa. So you're only a trefa if there is every reason to believe that nothing in the field of medical care will save your life. And I think that's still a useful category. The more complicated one to me is go sace, because go sace was generally thought to be someone who would die within 72 hours or so. But these days, we can keep people alive on life support almost indefinitely. So I think the question about a go sace is, would they die within 3 days without a respirator, without a feeding tube, without the other things that may be sustaining their lives? That's not usually the way go sace has been understood. It's usually been understood to mean 3 days with all those medical interventions. So it's distorted the concept. As a result, very few people are actually technically go sacim, because we never know how long they're going to stay alive on these machines. At the very least, I would want the definition of go sace to be explicit about how long they would stay alive without medical intervention. But there is certainly a case to be made for thinking about this differently. I mean, one of the big changes, as I'm sure you know, is the shift from respiration as the measure of death to brain death. And that by itself causes you to do a reinterpretation of what a go sace is. And the controversy about brain death revolves in part around which part of the brain waves are we measuring? Because there are always some electrical impulses that an EEG measures after most of us would agree death has occurred. So do we mean to apply the category of GOSES to cover all electric waves in the brain? I don't think so. And is it reasonable to take a concept which was a pre-modern concept when there were virtually none of these kinds of interventions available and apply it to the current situation, and not without a substantial amount of redefinition?
Right. And that's why the work that you're doing and several other of our colleagues in really pushing the envelope, trying to equate and interpret and reinterpret these traditional concepts from a time and frame that had no relationship to today and bring them into the contemporary world is so important, especially in these areas of bioethics and end of life. I mean, I would like to just get your opinion, just this whole interest in revitalization and renewal of interest in end of life conversations and the legislation and the conversation across denominational and religious lines. How much do you think is being generated by the fact that the baby boom generation is now looking at this square in the eye, their own mortality, and saying, you know, we've tried to control everything else in our life. I think we're going to try and control our own death. Does that have anything to do with this?
Maybe to some extent, but I think it's, if anything, it's more about the boomers burying their parents and being well aware of it. But, you know, the Ethics Center at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College gets a lot of requests for guidance. And I would say close to 80% of them are bioethical questions. They're bioethical questions because doctors and nurses and hospital social workers and rabbis are all being confronted by these questions every single day. And unlike most other fields of ethics, the week doesn't go by when there isn't some technical shift that results in answering these questions somewhat differently. So you both have a very large audience interested in these questions, both lay people and professionals. The variety of professionals having to deal with these questions in an ongoing way is broader than ever. And my sense is that it's the huge shift in technical capacity that is the single biggest driver of these questions, because the old answers don't quite fit anymore, as the questions you posed indicate.
I'd like to just shift gears for a second in the little time we have left on the podcast. And again, thank you. And again, we're speaking with Dr. David Teutsch, professor of contemporary Jewish civilization at the Reconstructionist Rabbinic College and the director of their Center for Jewish Ethics. David, a couple of years ago, you wrote a book based upon a lot of your work on called Making a Difference, about Jewish leadership and nonprofit management. And you've done training, you've done work in the field of Jewish leadership. And I wanted to ask you, in the time we had left, to just comment on, really, in your opinion, given the fact that you've seen this shift, as a lot of us in our generation have, of Jewish leadership, synagogue life, the demands, the stresses and strains upon being a Jewish leader, what does it take to be a significant Jewish leader in what is really an age of transition, where everything seems to be shifting, that one colleague of ours wrote a couple of years ago, that the clock of Jewish life seems to be shifting? What does it take? What's going on?
Well, the first thing to note is that we're dealing with external forces, political, economic, social, techno-scientific, that are accelerating the rates of broad social change in every way possible. And those various elements of change interact with each other to further increase the rate of change. So the rate of change not only is at this moment enormously rapid, but continuing to accelerate. And there's no reason to believe that isn't going to occur over the next few years. So the first thing to note is anybody who moves into the leadership who's going to be successful today has to be extraordinarily flexible, realizing that what works today is probably not going to work tomorrow, and has to be somebody who can ride the waves of that turbulence without being continually thrown off by them. Because of that rate of change, our Jewish organizations and their programs and their ways of marketing have had to change. Just the changes that computers, internet, et cetera, have brought have been enormous and have caused most institutions to redesign the way they conduct their everyday operations. So cell phones also. And we have seen nothing yet in terms of where the technological revolution is going to go. So we know that we're operating under conditions that are causing constant shifts in demographics, constant shifts in interests, and that institutions that used to be quite hierarchical need to become flatter and flatter in order to adjust to the rapidly changing times we're in. So we want leaders who are visionary, who are flexible, who have stamina, and who have wonderful interpersonal skills, because under these conditions of rapid change, people depend more on interpersonal connection to hold the Jewish community together than we have had to do in many generations.
So the rapidity of change in this age of transition, it seems again that despite the accelerated change, one of the keys for leadership is the importance, the power, and the presence of personal relationships. Would I be misstating that?
No, I absolutely agree. And those personal relationships have got to be able to be put into service of the ideas and ideals that will cope with change as time goes by.
We've been speaking with Dr. David Teutsch, the professor of contemporary Jewish civilization at Reconstructionist Rabbinic College and the director of the Center for Jewish Ethics. David, thank you very, very much for your time and just some wonderful ideas and your thoughtfulness. And I wish you continued success and everything and good health. That's most important thing. So thank you very much for being a guest here on our Jewish Sacred Aging podcast series. And take care. Shalom.
My pleasure.
To all of you, thank you very much for joining us. Again, podcasts are available on our website, jewishsacredaging.com. Until the next time, we wish you peace and joy and much health. Shalom.